Hi, this is Donna Hudson with the Decatur Herald and Review dated Monday, September 7th, 2026. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article titled, Bonds Forged by 9/11 in Iraq. Coles County Chief Deputy Still Values Service in Guard. This article is by Rob Stroud, Dateline Charleston. Tyler Helene was still a senior at Paris High School when he enlisted in the Army National Guard in August 2001, just a few weeks before the 9/11 terrorist attack. Helene, who is now chief deputy with the Coles County Sheriff's Office, said as a high school student he did not completely understand the magnitude of what he and his classmates were watching on the news on September 11, 2001 and the following day. What I remember most was the confusion and how quiet everyone seemed to be, Helene said. There was a feeling that something had changed, even though we didn't yet know exactly what that change would mean. Enlisting in the Guard. While still preparing for his senior year and for graduation, Helene said he enlisted in the Guard and its Paris-based 1544th Transportation Company as a way to get college money and life experience. He said 9/11 was not the reason he joined the military like it was for many other young people during that time, but the attacks absolutely changed the way he looked at serving. The commitment I had made suddenly carried a different meaning. There was a new sense of purpose and a stronger desire to serve my country. The possibility of being called upon was no longer something that seemed distant or theoretical, Helene said. Deploying to Iraq. After graduating, Helene completed his basic and advanced individual training at Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri. He subsequently deployed with the 1544th in 2004 to Iraq, where his company was based at Log Base Sites near Baghdad International Airport. Helene said the experience of that deployment shaped him in ways he could never have understood as a high school student watching the events of 9/11 and its aftermath. Iraq taught me about service and leadership, but it also taught me about grief and loss. It taught me what true friendship looks like and how important camaraderie is, Helene said. Many of the soldiers in the 1544th at the time were recent high school graduates and college students from Paris and other area communities, many of whom knew each other before enlisting. The 1544th soldiers spent much of the deployment escorting civilian truck drivers from the United States who were transporting mail and supplies to service members in Iraq. They faced constant threats from improvised explosive devices and other attacks. Helene said those bonds have been strengthened by veterans of Log Base Sites, an organization that provides support and resources to veterans and their families through educational programs, outreach events, and annual retreats. Reflecting on 9/11, when he thinks about 9/11 today, Helene said he views it through several different perspectives. I see it as a veteran who served in a war that followed those attacks. I see it through the eyes of someone who has spent a career in law enforcement. And I see it simply as an American, a husband, a father, and a member of a community, Helene said. All these different perspectives are why Helene believes that remembering 9/11 is so important. We remember the innocent civilians who went to work, boarded airplanes, or started what they believed would be an ordinary day, and then never came home. We remember the firefighters, police officers, paramedics, and other first responders who ran toward danger while everyone else was trying to escape it. Helene added that, we also remember the service members who answered their country's call in the years that followed, including those who never returned home and those who came home carrying wounds and experiences that remained with them for the rest of their lives. Remembering the fallen. Veterans of Long Base Sites report that the 1544th is bonded over the loss of five soldiers and the wounds endured by 28 Purple Heart recipients during a year-long tour on what is considered to be one of the most heavily mortared bases in Iraq. The 1544th lost Staff Sergeant Ivory L. Phipps of Chicago, Specialist Jeremy L. Ridlin of Moroa, Sergeant Shauna Morrison of Paris, Specialist Charles Lamb of Casey, and Sergeant Jessica L. Covey of Mahomet. Helene said the responsibility to remember is also something he and his wife try to pass on to their five-year-old son. He said they want him to grow up understanding the importance of honoring those who serve their country, whether they wear a military uniform or serve as a first responder. We try to take him to memorials, ceremonies, and community events that recognize those who are serving and, just as importantly, those who paid the ultimate sacrifice. He is still young and may not fully understand it yet, but we want respect for service and sacrifice to be something he grows up with, Helene said. Participating in the Illinois Run for the Fallen in Charleston has become an annual tradition for Helene. He runs 5 laps in memory of his lost comrades from the 1544 while wearing a T-shirt bearing their names. His son Jagger joined him this year for part of the run. For me, never forget has become much more than a phrase. It means remembering the people who were lost, honoring the people who stepped forward, recognizing the sacrifices that continued long after September 11th, 2001, and making sure the next generation understands why those sacrifices matter. Helene added that, "I enlisted before 9/11, but there is no question that September 11th helped define the soldier I became and ultimately had an impact on the course of my military career and the course of my life." Our next article is on Illinois healthcare, and is entitled $4 billion at Stake in Medicaid Change Study, Rule to Limit Payments for Sites for Vulnerable Patients. This article is written by Peter Hancock of Capital News Springfield. Dateline Springfield. Illinois hospitals stand to lose upwards of $4 billion in revenue over the next several years due to impending changes in Medicaid rules that limit states' ability to direct higher reimbursement payments to facilities that serve the most vulnerable populations. That's according to a recent study by KFF, a nonpartisan health policy think tank, as well as estimates by the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. And unless Congress acts to reverse those policies before they take full effect, IHA officials warn, roughly half of the hospitals in Illinois could be forced to reduce staff, cut back on services, or close altogether. The governor's people have consistently said that they don't have a printing press over in the Capitol and that they're not going to be able to fill in this revenue, David Gross, IHA's senior vice president for government relations, said in an interview. So it's a concern that some of the estimates that have been undertaken in Washington assume that the state's going to pick up the cost of these cuts. State-directed payments. The upcoming change affects a little-known practice within Medicaid known as state-directed payments, or SDPs. Those are supplemental reimbursement rates that some hospitals are paid for specific services. Most states today, including Illinois, operate their Medicaid programs under a managed care model. That means they pay for-profit health insurance companies a flat per-person fee each month to manage the care of Medicaid recipients. Those companies, known as managed care organizations, or MCOs, are then responsible for reimbursing the hospitals and other providers for the services they provide. Currently, states are allowed to direct their MCOs to pay higher reimbursement rates to particular hospitals for specific services to help keep those facilities financially viable or to make sure certain services remain available in their communities. They are a critical piece to ensuring that hospitals are able to provide access to the Medicaid population in Illinois and across the country, said Ben Winnick, IHA's Vice President of Healthcare Finance. Nearly all states use SDPs as part of their overall Medicaid payment system. Gross described them as a way to enhance what have traditionally been low Medicaid rates in states. New federal limits. For several years, according to KFF, federal rules have capped these state-directed payments at the average rate paid by commercial insurers for those same services. Commercial rates tend to be about twice the rate paid by Medicare and more than twice the rate paid by Medicaid. But under the Budget Reconciliation Act passed by Congress in 2025, known as H.R. 1 or the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, states like Illinois that expanded their Medicaid programs under the Affordable Care Act will see their cap lowered to 100% of the Medicare rate. The handful of states that did not expand their Medicaid programs will be capped at 110% of the Medicare rate. These new caps will be phased in over a number of years, starting in 2028. Our last article from the front page is on the war in Ukraine. U.S. envoys hopeful after Ukraine-Russia visits. This article is by Max Hunter of Reuters. Dateline Kyiv, Ukraine. United States peace envoys Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff heralded new momentum in peace talks after meeting Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday in Kyiv as the Trump administration renewed its push to end Russia's four-year-old war in Ukraine. Kushner and Witkoff traveled from Moscow, where they held 3 hours of talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Saturday, but did not appear to secure a breakthrough in the conflict. Witkoff, President Donald Trump's envoy, said they heard new ideas in Moscow, which they did not detail, and they hoped a new round of U.S.-mediated Ukraine-Russia talks would be announced in short order. Zelensky praised the very substantive conversation with Witkoff and Kushner and said Ukraine was ready for trilateral talks. He said he also discussed air defense supplies and energy support for Ukraine ahead of winter, with Russia expected to bomb Ukraine's power grid again. Previous rounds of U.S.-mediated peace talks encouraged by Trump, who campaigned on a promise to quickly end the war, have yielded few results. He suggested Friday that the U.S. had a fresh proposal, though he did not elaborate. Kremlin aide Yuri Ushakov described Saturday's meeting as highly useful, while a White House official told Reuters that next steps would be announced in the coming weeks. "We made a lot of progress in Moscow," Witkoff told reporters Sunday in Kyiv, adding that he was very encouraged by his conversations with the Ukrainian team. The Ukrainian president, who believes Washington will be key to a peace deal, has said a window of opportunity to make peace exists before the U.S. begins focusing on its next presidential election in 2028. The U.S. envoys held several hours of talks with Ukrainian officials. British, French, and German national security advisors, who were also in Kyiv, joined for the final hour. The U.S.-Ukrainian discussions were due to continue Sunday evening. During a break, Zelensky said officials discussed the possibility of security and economic guarantees for Kyiv, as well as a post-war prosperity plan. "In the last 10 to 12 months, I believe we have got stronger," Zelensky said, adding that the U.S. and Europe noted this. Witkoff and Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, have visited Moscow several times in their roles as peace envoys. But Sunday was their first visit to Kyiv in their capacity as U.S. negotiators. Their visit was long sought by Ukraine's leadership, and on the streets of Kyiv, which has been bombarded heavily in recent weeks, some residents were hopeful. "The issue can be solved in the blink of an eye. We want peace," said military veteran Stepan Yermak. "I've fought myself, so I know what war is like. We need peace because there's no other way." In previous talks, the sides remained far apart on key issues, including the future of the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbas. Russia has demanded Ukraine's withdrawal from a belt of towns that it still controls there, but Kyiv has refused, reasoning that it can still hold on. "The question of Donbas, I believe, is the question of this war," Zelensky told reporters Sunday. For Ukraine, hard security guarantees from its European allies and the U.S. are crucial to Hard security guarantees from its European allies and the U.S. are crucial to deterring Russia from invading again. Although he said the issue had been discussed, Zelensky did not detail if progress was made. Though the front lines of the ground war remain largely static, both Russian and Ukrainian forces have intensified long-range airstrikes in recent weeks. Russia pounded the Ukrainian capital day and night with missiles and drones for the last 2 weeks, including an attack on Friday on the headquarters of the SBU Security Service. The Kremlin said it would pause strikes on Kyiv until Monday, while Zelensky said Ukraine would also halt strikes on Moscow. There was no let-up in fighting along the 750-mile front, however, and Russia bombarded other Ukrainian cities on Saturday. Ukraine inflicted damaging hits throughout the summer on Russian refineries, oil terminals, and the warehouses of online retailer Wildberries in an attempt to raise the cost to Moscow of continuing the war. Ukraine said Sunday it struck the Ryazan oil refinery about 300 miles inside Russia overnight, causing a fire. Now we move on to the next section with an article on real estate entitled Small Towns, Big Prices, the 10 most expensive U.S. non-cities ranked by median home value. This article is by Daniel DeVise of USA Today. Two island getaways off the coast of Massachusetts rank as the most expensive small towns in the United States. Nantucket and Vineyard Haven have the priciest homes among all U.S. towns, according to a new report from the personal finance site LendingTree. The nation's most expensive towns defy common wisdom about living costs, which suggests towns are generally cheaper than cities. A typical home costs more in Nantucket than in San Jose, California, which LendingTree tags as the nation's priciest large metropolitan area. There are definitely small towns that are as expensive as the most expensive big cities in this country, said Matt Schultz, chief consumer finance analyst at LendingTree. And in many cases, it's not driven by the people who live there. Many of the priciest towns rank as prime vacation spots, with populations that swell in summer or winter, with visitors who seek sand and surf or snow. If you're looking at Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, Breckenridge, Steamboat Springs, most of these are vacation places and high-end vacation places, Schultz said. Definitions of town vary widely. For this analysis, LendingTree looked at places with populations between 10,000 and 49,999. The ranking excludes expensive suburbs such as Scarsdale, New York, that are part of larger metropolitan areas. Here are the 10 most expensive towns in the U.S. based on median home value. Number 1, Nantucket, Massachusetts. With a median home value of $1.6 million, this town is the most expensive in the U.S. The island getaway swells in population from 14,000 to 80,000 or more in July and August. More than half of homes are seasonal. Number 2, Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts. Part of Martha's Vineyard, this is the second most expensive U.S. town, with a median home value of $1.2 million. It's another island retreat with more than half of homes put to seasonal use. Number 3, Jackson, Wyoming. Better known as Jackson Hole, the name of the valley where it sits, and once populated by Native Americans, it's esteemed for its ski resorts. Its median home is worth $1.1 million. Number 4, Breckenridge, Colorado. Another skier's paradise, its median home value is $748,200. Almost half of the homes are seasonal. Number 5, Hood River, Oregon. At the crossing of the Columbia River Gorge and the Cascade Mountain Range, it's known as the windsurfing capital of the world. The median home value is $660,000. Haley, Idaho is number 6. In the central Idaho Rockies, straddling national forests in the Wood River Valley, the town's median home value is $607,600. Number 7, Steamboat Springs, Colorado. Another ski town, one that apparently doubles as a green mountain paradise in warmer months, its median home value is $564,500. Number 8, Port Townsend, Washington. On the Olympic Peninsula, this town offers Victorian charm with an urban vibe, according to a tourist site. One magazine called it the Paris of the Pacific Northwest. The median home price is $535,000. Number 9, Ellensburg, Washington. 2 hours from Seattle, set along the Yakima River, this is both a college town and a rodeo town. Its median home value is $497,400. Number 10, Los Alamos, New Mexico. Not far from Santa Fe, at the foot of Pajarito Mountain, is a land of canyons and mesas. This town is best known as the birthplace of the Manhattan Project. Its median home value is $495,800. Other noteworthies. Didn't see your favorite small town paradise in the top 10? It may lurk further down the list. Here are a few other notable towns among LendingTree's top 50 for median home value. Number 11, Astoria, Oregon. Oregon's oldest city and the first permanent U.S. settlement west of the Rockies, according to a tourist site, its median home value is $468,300. Number 13, Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina. Surely the name alone would beckon visitors to Kill Devil Hills, a town on North Carolina's Outer Banks. It's a beach resort and the site of the inaugural human flight. Its median home value is $460,400. Number 16, Cody, Wyoming. Founded by Colonel William Buffalo Bill Cody, this town still offers rodeos and fake gunfights set amid authentic frontier storefronts. Its median home value is $400,500. Number 20, Taos, New Mexico. Home to Taos Pueblo, a World Heritage Site, and a plethora of galleries and museums, this town's median home value is $382,800. Number 29, Crescent City, California. Near lush redwood forests and boasting an 1856 lighthouse, this coastal town's median home value is $342,000. Number 31, Laramie, Wyoming. This town is home to the University of Wyoming and is a magnet for outdoor enthusiasts. The median home value is $333,000. Number 46, Bennington, Vermont. Home to Bennington College, this town is tucked between the Taconic and Green Mountains. It's associated with a Revolutionary War battle and is also a must-see for Donna Tartt buffs. The median home value is $279,900. Our last article on page 3 is entitled, Kennedy Center Ceiling Collapse Adds to Debate. This article is by Anthony Thompson of USA Today. A portion of the ceiling in the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts collapsed Friday evening after heavy rain swept through the Washington, D.C. area, prompting officials to temporarily close the building and renew calls for long-planned renovations. No one was injured when part of the ceiling in the building's grand foyer fell, according to the Kennedy Center. Photos released by the center showed chunks of ceiling material, dust, and debris scattered across the red carpet. Within hours of the collapse, Kennedy Center officials argued that the incident underscored the need to overhaul the aging facility. Another warning we can't ignore, the Kennedy Center said in an Instagram post. A section of the grand foyer ceiling collapsed after this week's storms. Thankfully, no one was hurt. Decades of deferred maintenance made this inevitable. The post added, Chairman President Trump has been right. America's cultural center needs to close, renovate, and be restored now. USA Today reached out to the Kennedy Center on Saturday, seeking additional comment. According to ABC News, the Kennedy Center's main building was closed immediately after the collapse Friday night. While the rest of the building was expected to reopen Saturday, the grand foyer will remain closed to visitors and non-essential personnel through the weekend, the outlet reported. Kennedy Center spokeswoman Roma Davari told ABC News that the collapse was another example of the urgent need to close for renovation and revitalization. The ceiling failure stems from decades of neglect and deferred maintenance by the previous leadership, Davari said. The Kennedy Center, which opened in 1971, was established by an act of Congress during the Eisenhower administration and later designated as a living memorial to President John F. Kennedy after his assassination. The collapse comes as the Kennedy Center board's plan to temporarily close the facility for a 2-year renovation remains tied up in federal court. Last month, the board approved a renovation project expected to cost more than $250 million. Representative Joyce Beatty, Democrat of Ohio, challenged the closure plan in court. Justice Department lawyers argued that the building needs extensive repairs, citing water damage and rusting steel, according to The Hill. The administration also warned in court filings that the center eventually could face demolition if those repairs are not completed, though officials said that is not the current plan. Congress appropriated $257 million for the project, and the Trump administration said it hopes to raise an additional $500 million through private donations to help restore and endow the center. The renovation proposal is also tied to a federal court plan to a federal court fight over plans to recognize Trump on the Kennedy Center. Last month, the board voted to place signage on the building reading, "The John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts, restored and renovated by President Donald J. Trump," and to rename its surrounding grounds President Donald J. Trump Plaza. The proposed changes remain tied up in federal court. Government lawyers argued that the wording would recognize Trump's role in renovating the building rather than formally renaming the Kennedy Center, while opponents argue that the move conflicts with an earlier court order that said only Congress could rename the facility. A sculpture that became a recognizable part of the Kennedy Center's grounds was removed this past week. Crews began removing Blue, a 24-foot aluminum sculpture created by famed American post-minimalist sculptor Joel Shapiro on Wednesday, USA Today reported. The National Park Service began implementing a temporary road closure early Wednesday to facilitate Blue's removal, according to a public notice. The artwork, gifted to the center in 2019, depicts a human stick figure poised in mid-kick, according to the Kennedy Center. It was located on the upper lawn of the center between the main Kennedy Center building and a separate venue called The Reach, which is used for arts education. The Kennedy Center did not publicly announce the reason behind the statue's removal. Now we'll move to page A4 for a quick look at the Decatur forecast. Today, high of 84 and mostly sunny. Tonight, mainly clear, low of 60. Tuesday, hot with sunshine, high of 92, low of 73. Wednesday, a stray thunderstorm, hot, high of 94, low of 66. Thursday, not as warm, high of 81, low of 58. Today's UV index is a 6, and today's air quality is moderate. The real feel today is as follows. 8 a.m., 64 degrees. Noon, 81 degrees. 4 p.m., 85 degrees. And 8 p.m., 70 degrees. The regional outlook for today says mostly sunny today. Expect 6 to 10 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity 55% and good drying conditions. Mainly clear tonight. Average relative humidity 80%. Okay, we're going to move on to the last article on page A4, which is entitled U.S. Healthcare Medicare GLP-1 Discount Has One Catch. Some sick patients don't qualify for weight loss drug program. This article is by Jackie Fortier of KFF Health News. We're going to see if we can get through some of this article before we have to take our break. In January, Jeff LaMarca got a prescription for the popular weight loss drug Zepbound, but he couldn't afford the $750 monthly price tag. Then Medicare launched an 18-month pilot program that offered GLP-1 medications to some enrollees for $50 a month. LaMarca thought he might finally be able to afford the drug. "I thought, thank God, there's a path," said LaMarca, who lives in Basking Ridge, New Jersey, and has tried numerous diets and exercise regimes. But the 68-year-old's celebration was short-lived. His application to the pilot program was denied. We're going to have to take our break now. Again, this is the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, September 7th, 2026. Our reading will continue with part two in just a moment.